what are you doing about your material?
He said, well, he said, I have about 50 pieces which have been performed, and he said, I'm a young man. He was then not even 40. And he said, I'd be interested in giving them to a university, but I want something in exchange. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, I'm getting a divorce, and Kathy, my wife, wants something, something, something. And he said, if she takes that, I have to be assured of an income of around $12,000 a year. So I went to Sydney and I said, you know, if Luciano Berio is so well known, to have him here as an adjunct for $12,000 a year and get all of his materials, plus he agreed to give us anything which he wrote in the future. And he's been writing ever since, and he'll continue to write for another 20 years. Well, again, the music department said no, mainly Sarah Fuller and Billy Jim Layton and Bull Underwell said no, they didn't want Berio here, that he was not their style or something. I don't know quite how they put it. So I was forced to go to Berio and say, I'm sorry, but we can't manage that. And then the third thing that happened was Menotti. I got to know Menotti's publisher very well in New York, Bob Holton. And Bob called me one day and he said, are you still in the business of collecting archives? And I said, yes. And he said, how about Menotti? And I said, well, Giancarlo's work is, again, so well known that let's talk about it. Well, I no sooner broached that to Sid, who checked it with the music department, when the reaction came back, well, Menotti is no Mozart, and we're not interested in his work. So obviously it was a case of time and time again of the music department not wanting the center to be involved in any of this. Mm-hmm. Because here we could have collected Varese, Berio, and Menotti, which would have been, just those three would have been a substantial collection of music materials, original scores of all kinds, which would have attracted other people's materials, you know, people like John Cage and, you know, others. Today it would have been Glass. The modernists, the people on the cutting edge of modern music, we would have been ahead of every university in the country. But no, the music department didn't want this.
Where are those archives now?
Well, I think, I don't know where Menotti's are, I don't know where Berio's are. I think Chu still has the various archives of Columbia. But I continued throughout those years, those 9 years, to hold as many cultural events on campus as the budget could afford. We had a Bartok festival, which not only I was given, I think, $3,000 to run it, and made $9,000 profit. You know, we had the Budapest Orchestra over here, if you remember, and we had all kinds of people. We did one of the operas in the Union Auditorium. We were sold out. We had something like 5,000 people in the gym when the Budapest Symphony came in. And they played Bartok, they also played Tchaikovsky, and, you know, it was a well-rounded program. Well, then the Fine Arts Center loomed on the horizon. And that created a whole new set of problems for Stony Brook, because the desire was to build a 3,000-seater, which would be large enough for you to do certain things. At that time, if you wanted Van Cliburn, you had to pay between $25,000 and $30,000 at that time. We're talking 10 years ago. And I guess now it would be $50,000. Well, in order for you to book Van Cliburn and make a profit, you have to have a certain number of seats. Otherwise, each seat goes up to $40 or $50, which at that time was completely out of the question. But the Fine Arts Center didn't turn out that way. It turned out to be an 1,100-seat
major auditorium, a 500-seat recital hall, and a number of small theaters, Theater 1, 2, and 3. Sidney appointed me his assistant in the provost office to kind of shepherd the whole Fine Arts Center to completion, not in terms of its architecture, but in terms of its staffing, its budgets, and its programming. And I did this as part of the Center for Arts and Letters. I was told in the first year, well, we can only have four positions. And I went to the art department and the other departments, and I evaluated what was really needed and came up with things like a sculpture technician and so on. And phase one went up, which was the music department and the art department. At the time, I was teaching in the art department, still, teaching kinetics. And Lawrence Alloway was very upset with the exhibit area,
gallery?
The gallery. Because it wasn't designed the way he wanted it. And he absolutely refused to talk to anybody about this. And Jacques Gilmain, who was chairman, said to me, Lou, you're the only one that seems to get along with Lawrence. Why don't you sit down with him and see what he wants? So Lawrence and I went through the gallery, and he pointed out that walls were in the wrong place, or were scheduled to be in the wrong place because no walls were up, and lighting was wrong and what have you. And I made some very careful notes and sat down with Paul Damas, who was designing the building, and we straightened it all out to Lawrence's satisfaction. There were these kinds of crises which had to be solved, which I solved for Sydney. And phase two then came along. Meanwhile, we were still holding cultural events in the library or in the lecture center or over in the gym, because you couldn't hold anything. There were no performance areas in phase one. And then phase two came along, and suddenly the building was complete. Now we needed a much more rigorous series of control factors. For example, what do you do about the box office, which involves money? Money going in and money going out. Control of tickets, phone orders, credit orders. How do you interface with the main computer? What kind of staffing do you need in front of the house, the back of the house, these kinds of things? And a committee was formed with Charlie Kim as chair, an advisory committee, and I would bring preliminary decisions to that committee with Sid having talked with them about them to me beforehand, and we got all this set up. At the end of this,
Sid was then academic VP.
Mm-hmm.
Succeeding.
He was until 81. And the center was completed in 79. And of course, that was the year when, or the year before, I think John Toll left. And Dick, what's his name, came down, Schmidt.
Schmidt, right.
And then I think Jack Marburger came in late 79, 80. 80, yeah. But by 80, you see, everything was up and running. Now, I was asked, Dante Negro came in as a consultant and to set the whole thing up initially. And I was still at the Center for Arts and Letters, that was my official title, and assistant to the academic vice president for fine arts. And I'd also done a couple of other jobs for Sid. One of the things I'd done was do a study of this center, of the Educational Communication Center. That was back in 1976. And as a result of that, the whole center here was turned over and its functions were more clearly delineated. But, you know, we're talking about years when there were budget cuts after budget cuts after budget cuts. Not a year went by without us sitting down and figuring out how to save $1 million. One of the
husbands. This was Gary, was it?
Gary. So, Dante Negro came in, and I was asked, would I be interested in becoming director of the Fine Arts Center? And everybody assumed that I would be, because I had been handling cultural affairs for 9 years. I'd been associated with the Fine Arts Center in its development. I was in Sid's office, and so on. I was told by Sid, because of budget cuts, that there would be no further lines assigned to fine arts, to the front of the house, back of the house, box office, and so on, were then being undertaken by CETA people. You know CETA? Who were temporary, low paid, and so on. And CETA, I think, was coming to an end. At least it came to an end when Reagan came in. And when I said, well, how are you going to staff the place? Because you know what's needed, I told you. I was told, well, you're the fundraiser. You're going to have to go out and raise the money for these people.
And I said, no way. I said, I'm not going to be responsible for finding $100,000 a year for staffing for the Fine Arts Center. But if I did that, I'd be doing nothing else.
And I also had, programmatic discussions with Dante Negro. And we disagreed violently about the role of the Fine Arts Center. I had looked at other centers and in state universities, particularly Michigan and Indiana and a few other places, Iowa. And my idea of the Fine Arts Center, which has never come to fruition, was that it should be a regional arts center. And you see, what the way that Dante and Sid and the others, well, not Sid, because Sid supported me in certain ways, but the way that most people looked at the Fine Arts Center was that it would be a performance area that people who wanted to be involved in the arts would come to Stony Brook and sit down in the various auditorium and, you know, sit there the way they go to Lincoln Center. Well, there isn't an arts center, including Lincoln Center today, which doesn't have a regional outreach.
Outreach.
In other words, the what I developed for the Fine Arts Center, and it was approved in Albany, by the way. I wrote it up. I still have a copy of it. It was approved in Albany, but the budget, in fact, it was the only program approved for the whole campus for that year. Mitch Gerstel called me and said, Lou, I don't know how or why, but you've got the only program that Central always approves. And this was a community arts program, which entailed taking up plays throughout the county and perhaps throughout the two counties, taking out music groups, quartets, artists, poets, people in the arts, and going into high schools, BOCES, hospitals, prisons, and doing a, you know, having the Fine Arts Center generate art which can be more broadly viewed than a finite number of people sitting in an auditorium. And Dante disagreed totally with this. And I felt too, apart from the fundraising aspect of it, that I was fighting an uphill battle. I had talked to people like Billy Jim Layton, who was then chairman. He wasn't strong on the idea. Charlie Kim, I don't think he even understood what I was talking about. And but Sidney put it through. He asked me to develop the proposal. It went to Albany. It was approved. But that year, the budget cuts came down, and nothing was approved for Stony Brook. No new programs of any kind. So it died right there. And to this day, knowing that if the auditorium, the main auditorium in the Fine Arts Center, is filled,
then it is probably filled 65 to 85%
of people who work for Stony Brook. Considering that, you know, people like Klein, the county executive, and other people physically went to Albany to convince the legislature to fund the Fine Arts Center because, as they said, it was going to be a community resource. You know, the reason for its existence was wiped out. And it became, in effect, a very, I think, elitist institution. Don't argue with the programming that's put on there. Mm-hmm. And I certainly don't argue with the number and kind of events that are put on by faculty and students. That's all very necessary. But in conjunction with that, if Stony Brook, and Stony Brook these days is through Jerry Schubel, is very interested in community outreach in many, many areas. Mm-hmm. But this has never surfaced. And Terry Netta, the director, who's been director, first and only full-time director, has no... I talked to him when he came, and I just would have been talking Greek. You know, this is not his thing. He's a painter, you know. He knows nothing about music, nothing about theater. He admits it. So that was a big disappointment to me. And then in 1979, Frank Ryan, who was director here, resigned under duress. And Sid came to me and said, Lou, as well as running the Center for Arts and Letters, I want you to run the Media Center. And I said, Sid, it's a losing proposition.
Still on?
Good. Yeah. There have been 17 people online on staff
in 1976. And ECC, when he asked me to do this, was down to 8 positions,
of which we have since lost 4, by the way. And ECC had no credibility on campus,
despite all the studies that had been made and the changes which had taken place.
And I thought it was a losing proposition. But Les Pauldy, who was in charge of the ECC as dean of CED, came to me and said, Lou, you've got to do this. Otherwise it will close down. And I felt that to save the institution, I would take it over. So I spent about 40% of my time working for the Center for Arts and Letters, and about 60% of my time here. And I came in, and it was a mess. It was a total mess. People were not turning up for work. Large amounts of equipment couldn't be found. Programs had been agreed upon with people like chemistry and had never been produced. It was a shambles. So over a period of 8 or 9 years, I reorganized the place, you know, put systems in. I have a computer inventory. We know where people are all day long. And one of the great achievements was to get finally our television capital equipment, which we got 2 years ago. That was originally scheduled in 1971, turned down by Albany. The funding was there, but the approval was not. It was resubmitted in 1976. Same thing happened. 1983, I resubmitted it,
had extensive conversations with the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs in Albany.
Who was that?
That was Jane Altes, who is now, I think, she left the university.
How do you spell her name?
A-L-T-E-S.
Altes.
And with strong support from the theater department, and from Home O'Neill, and Graham Spanier, who was the Vice Provost for Undergraduate Studies at the time, to whom I reported after not reporting to Les Pauldy anymore. With the support of these people, we got it. And it was $700,000, which had been sitting there for 16 years.
Well, 12, 13 years. No. Last year was, what, 87?
16 years. And now we have a...
We're very, very productive. We have...
We're generating about $30,000 a year in IFO money.
You know, in non-state funds, income, which we use for equipment.
IFR?
Income fund reimbursable.
There was one development in the center about 1974.
The Museum Computer Network
came into the center. That was David Vance.
Yeah.
Frankly, I was against it coming into the center. And I told Sidney this. But Jack Heller knew these people very well. And I, you know, swallowed my misgivings, and they came in. And they were with us for roughly 10 years.
I've forgotten where Vance came from, which I think...
Museum Unknown. He was
the registrar there. Yeah. And Daly was a fine guy, and what he did was important.
But he had no interface with the campus. You see, he didn't teach. Nothing he was doing
interfaced with anything else on campus. It was an isolated kind of activity which had some peripheral importance, but had no academic base at all. And in 1983, when there was another series of cuts, Louise Vazvari in the provost's office, he was associate provost, persuaded Homenil to disband the Center for Contemporary Arts and Letters completely. And, you know, I received a letter telling me that it couldn't afford to function anymore, in effect.
And so...
Where did that money go?
I don't know. I have no idea.
She is...
She's been convalid.
Yeah. Do you know anything about her?
Not much. Bob Neville was the Dean of Arts and Sciences at the time I reported to him.
Was he the,
yes, he was the Dean.
Dean of Humanities.
Dean of Humanities and Fine Arts.
Yeah. Bob was the one who called me in. There was a very unfortunate accident there, which was that the Sydney in 1971 had given the Museum Computer Network a 5-year contract for being on campus.
And he was told in 1983, 2 years before the termination of his contract, to clean out his desk.
Did what?
He was told to clean out his desk, David Vance.
So this went back and forth, the legalities of the contract and all the rest of it. And he stayed until 1986. And then he left. And the whole operation left. And I think he retired. He just left the network completely.
It's tough when the budget begins to...
We're coming to the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's going to get worse. It's going to get much worse.
But I'm not, you know, I've had my ups and downs and my disappointments. I would say my greatest disappointment is fine arts, because I put a tremendous amount of work into fine arts. And it's successful. You know, I feel that Jack Marburger goes into the Fine Arts Center and there's a ballet or orchestra or something, and sits down in his seat, the curtain goes up, and everybody applauds. And if that's the measure of success, well, fine. But to me, it isn't. I was at Lincoln Center. Lincoln Center was very isolated. It was very elitist, you know, the Metropolitan Opera and all the rest of it. And it was only after I left that they began to develop programs that went into Harlem and went into Bensonhurst in Brooklyn, and summer programs which had street festivals and what have you. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have to spend $45 for a seat at the Met or the Philharmonic to be part of a Lincoln Center arts program. Mm-hmm. And they learned the hard way.
And I think one of these days we're going to learn the hard way.
It's successful, the Fine Arts Center is successful judging by the standards that are set. Mm-hmm. But they're the wrong standards.
Well, it's certainly a shame that the auditorium is only 1,100.
That is a shame. But Albany wouldn't have it any other way. Some of the memories I have of when I was in John Toll's office, of the student riots and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember one afternoon, I had two secretaries at the time, and black students came in, and they were big fellows too. They were 6 footers, 6'6". And they took over the whole of John Toll's office. They stationed themselves at the door, and they said, nobody goes in, nobody goes out. And they went over to the desks, and if you were on the telephone, they took the telephone out of your hand and put it down and disconnected you. And my two girls were absolutely terrified, completely terrified. And I said, come on, Susan, come on, Larry, put your coats on. And I went to the door, and here's this big fellow standing there. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I said, we're leaving. And he said, if you're leaving, you can't come back. And I said, who in God's earth would want to? And out we went. Mm-hmm. The following morning, I went to see Alec. Alec was acting president at the time. And there was a system which had been set up because of all bomb scares and what have you. But everybody in the top administration was assigned a building. And you had to be there all night. Dave Dixon was the one who was organizing this. Mm-hmm. And I found out that I was being assigned to ESS, I think. I think it was ESS. And I said to Alec, you know, I'm a veteran of World War II. I fought for many things, including personal liberty. And I refused to be kidnapped by anybody. So Alec said, well, I'm taking you off the list. You don't have to go to a building. Oh, I was angry. I was very angry. I didn't feel anybody had the right to do what they had done. And then, you know what they were beefing about? They were beefing about the fact that they had... It was the beginning of the AIM program, and they were assigned state cars and, you know, to do whatever they want with, stipends of all kinds, and it was the first year. And this was around February or March, right in the middle of the spring semester. And they had heard that the second batch of AIM students was coming in that September. And they wanted to be absolutely sure that what they had would stay with them and that the new students wouldn't be taking anything away from them. And then we had the Black Panthers at a meeting in John's office. And the head of the Black Panthers was a woman who refused to talk to a white man. And she had her interpreter sitting beside her. So if I asked a question, I addressed it to him. He whispered it in her ear. She whispered the answer back to him, and he would tell me what the answer was.
When was this 71?
71, yeah. Maybe it was before, no, it was before then. It was about 69, I think. Late 69, early 70.
I was away on sabbatical from September 69 to August 31st, yeah, of 70.
It was in that period, Tom. But there were, you know, it was a strange, strange thing. I remember they took over Bentley Glass's office. This is when we were in the library. You remember the library? And they took a lot of his personal mementos. You know, he put out a notice to the campus saying that
He would give a reward, no questions asked, for
something which he'd had for about 30 or 40 years, which had been stolen from his desk. It's a very, very strange... If it hadn't been happening on other campuses, the fact that it was happening on other campuses reduced the level of anxiety here. We felt it was... Remember that...
It wasn't specifically directed at Stony Brook.
No. Remember the president of Notre Dame came out with a statement in which he said the attack on administrative people at universities is attacking a toothless tiger. Do you remember that?
No, I've heard.
And the trustees are the ones who are fundamentally responsible for policy and not the administration. We are there simply to carry it out.
They're our Hesburgh.
Hesburgh.
Yeah.
I've always remembered that phrase, a toothless tiger. It's a marvelous phrase. There's a few minutes left, Carl. Uh-huh. Still a few minutes.
Okay.
I have it on the slow speed, so...
Yeah.
Well, what else can I tell you, Carl? It's a very checkered career, and I don't regret any part of it.
Well, you certainly have been... a multi-purpose individual who has... stayed with the institution and been loyal to it.
Yeah, tried to be.
Yeah.
I tried to be calm.
And I'm glad I brought you in.
Well, I'm glad you did. I never regret it. I regretted it once or twice, but I've always gone home and said, well, you know, this too shall pass.
Yeah.
Stony Brook, 15 or 20 years from now, there'll probably be a person who's responsible for anything around here that will still be here. And the institution will still be here.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you think of all the men who've left, retired, died, who had major roles in Stony Brook. I'm talking about chairs of departments when there were no departments and so on. And we still remember them.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of people like Ray Jones and Ashley Schiff and people like Jerry Singer, who's now left, and, you know, Herb Weisinger, Harry Kalish.
I've got those two.
Yeah. Well, Jerry's in Washington. He would be a good man to see if he ever got down there.
Jerry Singer.
Yeah, Jerry Singer.
Now, he was in psychology.
Right.
Yeah. Do you have his...
I don't, but David Glass knows where he is.
I see.
David's right there in the provost office.
I see. David Glass. All right.
You ought to talk to Ken Dray, too, when you get a chance.
Ken?
Ken. Ken was in admissions back in 1965 and 6, before he came here. He remembers that whole era of Dave Tilley and... You might look for Frank Bonner's first tape, Carl. You probably have it somewhere.
I'm surprised.
Is dead, isn't he? Stan Ross is here.
I don't know. Is that off? That's off now, isn't it?
No, it's not.